Let me welcome you again, those of you in the room, and especially those of you watching online or joining us. We're so glad you're here for Easter. You know, Easter is a funny sermon to give, because my guess is there's nobody in the room that is uncertain about what I'm going to say. Like, you all know how this story goes, right? You showed up recognizing that I'm going to tell you that the cross has no one hanging on it anymore, that the tomb is empty and Jesus is alive. Like, you've got the facts. You probably know how the story goes. You might even have a good grasp of the characters that are in it. I mean, you got this thing down pat. And yet I got to try to tell you something that would make you believe that there's more to it than just the story. Sometimes we have just the facts, and the facts don't always lead us to the truth. So here's the question that I have for us that I want to try to answer over the next few minutes. And that is this: whether or not you know the story, what difference does Jesus' resurrection make in your life? Like, what difference has it made in your life in the last year? Maybe since the last time you were here. Happy Easter. The funny thing is, sometimes we can have all the right info and come to the wrong conclusion. Like, you remember that movie, The Sixth Sense? Everybody, if you haven't seen it, you've had 26 years. I'm sorry, I'm about to spoil it for you, but everybody had the same info. We all watched it and had the same information, and at the end, you realize they're dead, right? Right info, all the facts, wrong conclusion. The story that I want to share with you today, a little bit about this first Easter, is exactly like that. The people had all the facts. They just missed the truth. It's Easter afternoon. It's the day that Jesus had risen. And what's happened as we pick up the story in Luke 24 is that Mary has gone to the tomb that morning, and she's found it empty, and she's very confused. In fact, she thinks that Jesus is the gardener. She runs into him and just doesn't recognize him. And then some of the other disciples, Peter and John, they run to the tomb. They look in. He's not there. Grave clothes are folded up real nice. They don't understand what's happening. Everybody is experiencing doubt and darkness and uncertainty, maybe like you feel today. In the middle of all of that, there's a story of these two guys, two disciples, making their way back from the city after it's all said and done, and they see how everything went. They are firmly aware of the facts of their life. And Jesus shows up. Here's how it goes. Luke 24, starting in verse 13. It says, "Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. And as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them. But they were kept from recognizing him." Just want to pause right there for a second. And when I read this story, it always makes me think they were kept from recognizing him. Like, maybe God kept them. He had their eyes shut, or some way he was concealing it. Maybe it was because Jesus was so beaten and battered and he just looked different that they weren't able to recognize him. But I think sometimes you and I experience the same thing. Like, let me ask you, what keeps you from recognizing that Jesus is with you? Sometimes it's our despair. It's our disappointment. It's our unmet expectations, unanswered prayers. Don't you and I sometimes have difficulty recognizing he's right there? He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these last days?" Which is kind of funny, right? Of all the people in Jerusalem, Jesus is the one person that actually does know everything that's happened the last few days. And poor Cleopas, he gets his name put in the Bible so we can just make fun of him for thousands of years after that. The question they ask is, "Where have you been?" And what I think is really interesting is Jesus could have answered that differently. He could have said, "Well, so Thursday night, having dinner with the boys, celebrating Passover. Can you believe it? One of them sold me out for 30 pieces of silver. That's not a lot, by the way. He could have said, where have I been? After dinner that night, we walked into this ancient garden where I started feeling something shift. The darkness and the weight of the world started to come on me. It was so heavy that I got down on my knees in this garden, and under the moonlight, as the clouds covered and the darkness continued to press in, I prayed like I've never prayed before. And I was begging God, please, is there any other way? And I felt the weight get heavier, and the stress and the anxiety grew deeper, and I began to sweat blood. The capillaries in my face and my forehead, they broke under the intense pressure that I felt, which is a real medical condition, by the way, that happens in extreme cases of distress and fear. You can look it up. Where have I been? I got up in that garden, and some soldiers came, and the friend, that guy, you know his name, he showed up and he gave me the kiss of death. That's where we get that phrase. He kissed me, and then in a moment, all my friends left. They all abandoned me. Everybody ran away. I wonder if you felt like that before. And in the darkness, they dragged me off to court, and for the next few hours, back and forth, six different times, criminal, civil, court, all of it made up. They dismissed me and hired witnesses to lie about me, and they convicted me. In the early morning Friday, where have I been? They dragged me and beat me. They punched me. They spit on me. They ripped my beard out with their hands. They pressed thorns into my skull. They whipped and flogged me until my back was shredded meat, just the exposed nerves and blood and flesh to the point of death. And then they had me carry my own execution. They had me carry a cross outside the city to a place called Golgotha, and they took and they ran nails through my wrists and into my feet, and they attached me to that cross, and then they raised it up, and as it sunk into the ground, I fell. And the back that was flayed open because of the beating was now scratched against the rugged wood of the cross. And I experienced more pain than anyone has ever experienced in their life. And that was just the start. Because then God the Father, the one that I have been one with for eternity, he allowed all the sin and all the shame and all the pain and all the guilt of every human who has ever lived to be put on me. It weighed on me. My psyche, my spirit, my body absorbed it all. And then he unleashed holy justice. When I had taken every bit of it, he unleashed his anger, his wrath, his justice and judgment at me, and I hung in until it was all drained away. They stuck my chest with a spear. It pierced my heart. I yelled out, "It's finished," and I died. Expired. Took me off a cross. Put me in a tomb. Rolled a big stone in front of it. And my body, in the silence, finally silence. No more screaming. No more mocking. No more jeering. Just silence. I began to decompose. I was dead. That's where I've been. But sometime this morning before daybreak, a shock of divine power went through my body and my brain waves started to oscillate again and my heart began to pump blood and I began to be revived and I came back to life. Oh, it gets better than that. I didn't just come back alive. I didn't just get warm. I stood up, and as I did, I felt that God had done something, that all the shame and guilt that I had handled on Friday now was done, and he was no longer angry, and he was no longer wrathful, but now he was just inviting. And I looked at it, and I had taken sin and shame, and I had crushed them, and I grabbed death by the neck, and just like it had broken my body, I broke its back. And I walked out of that tomb with authority over sin, death, grave, and hell. The demons shrieked in terror as the angels roared in heaven, and the angels moved the tomb, and I walked out a free man. That's where I've been. How about you guys? He could have said it that way, but he didn't. He said, "What things?" "About Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people." Facts. "The chief priests, our rulers, handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him." Fact. "But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what's more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning. They didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said. But they didn't see Jesus." Facts. But the facts got in the way of the truth. That's why they lost hope. Because the circumstances surrounding their life looked as dark as they could ever be. But the truth was, hope was standing right in front of them. He had met them on the road home to hopelessness. Because it's possible for us to have facts and not truth. So what does Jesus do? He says to them, verse 25, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Didn't the Messiah have to suffer these things and enter his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, all the scriptures before, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." When you hear him say, like, "How foolish you are," don't hear the sneer, the critical, the hyper-judgmental sound. He didn't say, "How foolish." I think about, any of you ever taught a kid to ride a bike? You know how when they're first trying to figure it out, it's like up for a second, down. Up for a second and down. You're like, "Come on, buddy." That's what Jesus' voice sounded like. "You can do this. I know it's your mother's genes. Come on. You got this." How foolish. But then he says something really interesting. He says, "And slow to believe." See, foolish is not a case. It's not an issue of the head. It's not that they lacked information. They had it. It's an issue of the heart. It's that they were slow to choose to believe everything that they had seen. Which makes me ask the question, like, what are we slow to believe? Maybe in your life, like, you know all the facts of your story and your situation right now. What are you slow to believe? That God is still for you despite what you've experienced? Are you slow possibly to believe that God, what he's promised, he'll finish, what he'll do? Are you slow to believe? And this is what we're really slow to believe, right? That God is so astonishingly resourceful at bringing good out of bad. When Jesus told him all the old story, that's what he showed him. Every moment where it looked like things were going to end in defeat, and he grabs victory. From the youngest who wasn't supposed to be chosen to a small group of army. God was in the business of taking the odds and stacking them against him just in an unbeatable way. And then he always comes through. This is what God always does. They were slow to believe that was the fingerprints of Yahweh God on this situation too. That just because they had seen with their eyes the circumstances that were dark and hopeless, that out of that God could do good. I wonder if you're slow to believe that too. Like, if we walk into this day wondering if it makes any difference in our life. And maybe it's because, like them, they were really, really hard things. You've got real hard things. Maybe the loss of a friend or a spouse. And maybe the pressure, the academic pressure to finish school, and you've applied and you didn't get into the school that you wanted to get into. Maybe you didn't get into any school at all. And all of that is just weighing on you, and the anxiety is crippling. Maybe it's the pressure of comparison, of seeing other people and what they have or how they look, and you just feel completely unworthy. It's the friend that's turned their back on you. You got rejected by the peers. It's the fact that the last time you saw her, she walked out the door screaming at you. And you're slow to believe that this could ever get fixed. You're able to maybe put on your good clothes and show up here for Easter Day with the family, but your family's in conflict. It's being ripped apart, and you can feel it, and you know it. And the facts are that this might be the last Easter that you ever do brunch together. But you're slow to believe that God, in the middle of that, could turn it around. I don't know where you're slow to believe, but He does. Maybe you've been fighting the interminable, unending battle of Crohn's disease, and it feels as if this is as good as it'll ever be. Maybe you're a young couple struggling with infertility, and one more year has passed. All I know is that sometimes God does His best work in the dark, just like He did in that tomb that morning. It says in verse 28, as they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on. I love this. He's playing with them. They're walking home. Like, this is our turn. He's like, okay, guys, see you later. They're like, no, stay, please. Stay with us, for it's nearly evening. The day is almost over. And so He went in to stay with them. This is just a little note. Like, Jesus needs to be invited into your hopeless place. And when you invite Him, He always, spoiler alert, He always says yes. He's just so humble and so gracious that He won't force Himself into your mess. He waits for you to invite Him in, and maybe that's your step today, is to invite Him into the hopeless places. So He gets inside the house, and they have a meal. It says, when He was at table with them, He took bread, and He gave thanks, and He broke it, and He began to give it to them. And then their eyes were opened, and they recognized Him. Now they have the truth. And He disappeared from their sight. How rude. Finally, yes, He's in. Oh, man. But they ask each other, weren't our hearts burning within us while He talked with us on the road? Even before we realized the truth, didn't we feel something rising up? That something, that burning, that's hope. That's what happens, is sometimes it starts like a little flame and it feels like it is fragile, like it could be extinguished at any moment. But you begin to realize Jesus is with you and hope starts to rise. And maybe you find out, maybe this Easter you'll find out that hope sometimes grows the brightest in the middle of the hardest thing that you've ever been through. My friend and girl who goes to this church named Maddie Musselman-Wepsey has a story like that. She's lived her whole life doing harder things than most of us have ever been able to do. And she found that there was still more hard, and in the middle of that, Christ met her and gave her hope. And I want you to see her story so that you might find hope too. Check this out.
Get three consecutive gold medals.
6-on-4,
and Maddie Musselman takes advantage
back
of that placement
to match the
U.S. women.
Well, Maddie, thank you for taking some moments to sit and talk with us and for sharing your story. Water polo has been such a major part of your life. It's considered one of the hardest sports in the world. That's written by people who maybe don't play it.
Yeah.
Do you find it to be hard?
Yeah, I think water polo is the hardest sport in the world. Maybe I'm a little biased because I play it. Using one hand, you're treading water, you're physically, wrestling someone, you're swimming back and forth, and it's just like constant movement, back and forth, and that's why I find it so difficult. I was in the Rio Olympics. We got gold in Rio in 2016. I was in the Tokyo Olympic Games, which was in 2021, due to the postponement of COVID. I got gold in that Olympics as well. Ended up getting MVP at that Olympics. Pat and I met at a wedding. He knew the groom, I knew the bride. We were on the bus, like leaving the wedding reception, and he like threw an ice cube at me from afar, and I'll never forget. And it's kind of like actual icebreaker. He like full on threw an ice, hit me in the eye, and like waved at me, and it was kind of like, okay, he's cute. Like, didn't think much of it. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, he called me and left me a voicemail asking me on a date. He I was a grinder. He had to work for his athleticism and for his abilities in the water when he started playing water polo, and he wasn't as gifted as his siblings. So I find that kind of funny with the accomplishments that he did end up achieving. He was a part of the most winning team in NCAA history at UCLA. When he graduated from UCLA, he decided to hike to the base camp of Mount Everest, and then decided to sign up for the English Channel when we were dating, which is one of the hardest of the seven crossings, and he did it in 10 hours and 28 minutes, which was 8 hours faster than the time he told me he was gonna cross it, which just blew my mind.
And then you find out he did that swim 8 hours faster than he thought, and he had cancer.
Yes, he swam it with one lung. Pat was diagnosed on September 17th in 2023. The doctor called us. I remember it was like really late at night. It was like at like 7 p.m. We were kind of just like, what's happening? Like, what's going on? Like, not only do you have masses, but it is cancer. And not only is it cancer, it's a really rare cancer that even this doctor doesn't even know what it is. Once we got the diagnosis, whole family came. It wasn't until everyone left and flew home that Pat and I were like, we should get married. Like, I want to be in this with you until the very last day. Whether it's the last day that you're fighting cancer because you beat it, or it's the last day because you're going to heaven. And he was like, yeah, like that, I was thinking about that and I just didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to make it uncomfortable, but like there's no other person that I would want to like be my partner through this entire thing. So again, thank you for, you know, and all the people at St. Andrews for making it happen, because that happened in 4 days. And we were married, and he started chemo on that Monday.
I know how much it means to her. I know how hard she works. I've never been to an Olympics. It's my only goal right now to make it to Paris and to watch her play.
When you're going through something hard and you're also loving someone, that's hard. And we were always doing that.
Why do you think it's hard? It's just an interesting phrase you said, like it's hard to do that.
I mean, Jesus didn't live an easy life either. And so when I think about the story of Jesus and being a follower, and you look to him and he, you know, became man and felt all the emotions, he felt grief, he felt sadness, he wept. It validates the hard, because he lived the hardest thing that anyone could do. So when Pat was diagnosed and when he said, like, we have all the faith in the world because we have God, and he did that. And he put this in our lives for a reason, and it's on our path. 3 weeks prior to the Olympics, he was at an appointment at USC for a checkup, and he like mandated like, hey, we're gonna make this happen. His mindset was never gonna waver. He said it was the best time of his life and most likely the worst feelings he has ever felt in his life physically. When we got to Paris, I was just so excited to, you know, have everyone back in the stands and then to have Pat there. It just made the Olympics feel even more special than it already was. Pat loved our rivalry with Hungary. His first ever time watching me play, he flew out to Budapest, and it was against Hungary. So to go to the Olympics, we're playing Hungary in the quarterfinal game, and Pat was fired up. And again, he doesn't feel good. You know, he's just battling each breath.
USA! 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 USA!
He was just so in awe of the Olympics, but in awe of our team and the things that we've been doing, while I was also just in awe of him for showing up. So it was a really special moment to hug him after that game. As a partner, the worst feeling is feeling like you can't do anything. But the best thing you can offer is your faith. And I was always so proud of myself for speaking truth over Pat in the hope that I had for him. And so when it was coming to the end, I still had hope. I was like, you, no matter what, like the next breath you have is gonna be with Jesus. Like, and he like was like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, everyone's gonna be fine. Like, he was just so at peace with it. And I think the hope that was spoken over him through other people as well, through myself, through you, through friends, through family, like, I think got him through to that point where when he no longer could fight physically anymore, his mind was stronger than ever, and he knew where he was going. And I think that gave me a lot of comfort once it all happened. This past year, through all this that's going on in my life, I've never been closer to God. I'm just so thankful for it. Even though I want Pat to be here and I so badly wish it didn't happen, for me, it's that perspective is irreplaceable.
Based on what you've walked through, have your feelings or your thoughts about death changed?
Yeah, I'm not scared anymore.
That's what hope in hard things looks like. Because we all wanted the end of that story to go a different way. But it didn't, and yet, and I'm so grateful to Maddie and her willingness to share that story. In fact, it wasn't just her willingness, it was her desire. And we talked about earlier this year, she's like, I just want somebody that shows up at St. Andrew's on Easter to experience the hope I found. And she's still walking through hard things. She's a widow at 27. Figuring out how to do life. I watched Pat walk through that time where his body was getting weaker and his soul and his spirit was getting stronger. And that only happens because Jesus is alive. See, we can do a lot of hard things, but the one hard thing we could not do was to defeat death. So he did for you and for me. And because that's true, you don't have to be scared anymore. You don't have to believe that this is it. It had God's fingerprints all over it. So, what difference does the resurrection make? Well, it makes all the difference in the world. The question is, will you and I choose to take our slow-to-believe hearts and let them say yes to Jesus? The difference that resurrection hope makes is it gives answers to doubters, it gives forgiveness to sinners, and it gives hope to grievers. And I don't know where you find yourself in that today, but I sure am glad that we can have hope. Verse 33 says, those two disciples, they got up. And they returned at once to Jerusalem, back to the scene of the crime, back to the hard place where people were hoping to arrest them and to try them and to kill them, back where there was uncertainty and no future. But they came back different than they left. Now they came back. They found the 11 assembled together and they say, it's true. It's true. We've seen the risen Lord. And you're about to walk out these doors and you're going to go back into your life, to your own version of hard. And what I want to ask you is, could you choose today, this Easter, to allow Jesus first to meet you on your road? Secondly, to invite him in to your hope, your hopelessness. Let him bring what he does so well. And maybe then you can walk back into that place saying just like they did, it's true. It's true, it didn't turn out the way I thought, but he's with me still, it's true. This is not the end of the story, it's true. There's more than my eyes can see, because you can have the facts and you can have truth because Jesus is alive. And maybe somebody else needs you to tell them that. So if you want help with that today, maybe for the first time you want to choose to say, Jesus, I'll trust you. I don't even get it all, but I want to. Or maybe you just need somebody to walk alongside with you. There's a card in front of you that says connect. You can fill that out and you can drop it off as you leave. And we'll call you, walk through this with you, help you on your road to hope. But don't do it alone. Because you don't have to anymore. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you, thank you, thank you for this story. Unbelievable. Whether it's the story of a couple of folks walking home when everything looked like it was over, or the story of an Olympic athlete choosing hope when everything seemed to be over. This is just how you do. Jesus, thank you that today you make on an opportunity, an offer, an invitation for us to come and find hope and strength in you in the middle of our heart. I pray for all those who are experiencing something like that right now, that today you would join them in it. God, I pray that you'd let a little spark, a little flame begin to burn in their hearts of hope that is unexplainable just looking at the facts, but is undeniable looking at the truth. Jesus, I pray for those that are going to take a step today and for the first time place their trust in you and put it in your hand, put their life in your hand, and I ask that you'd meet them in that place. And God, would you help all of us to be the kind of folks that carry around not just Resurrection Sunday once a year, but resurrection hope every day into every situation so that we might say, it's true. It's true. The Lord is risen. And we pray all this, Jesus, in your strong and beautiful and resurrected name. And everybody said together, amen.